This episode of New Politics was released on the 20th of May, 2023, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, we look at the first year of the Federal Labor Government, what can be done about the many housing issues across Australia, the latest opinion polls, and the last Liberal government in the village is in a lot of trouble. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, crocodilian psychopath.
And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription, but whether it's a subscription or whether you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au, and all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. The Labor government has been in office for a year, and there have been some suggestions that it's the best first year of a government since Bob Hawke's first year between 1983 and 1984. When Labor won the election in May 2022, they promised eight key priorities for government, and that includes the Anti-Corruption Commission, an employment summit, a voice to Parliament, implementing all the recommendations of the Respect at Work report, an emphasis on climate change policy, reworking national agencies aligned to what was needed in the community rather than trying to achieve ideological goals, reworking the aged care system, and promising cheaper childcare. In most of these areas, the government has made substantial work, with the exception of climate change policy. The Anti-Corruption Commission commences on the 1st of July. Many recommendations from the Respect at Work report have been implemented. The referendum on the voice to Parliament is due to take place by the end of this year. The Job Summit was held in September last year. Agencies such as the Administrative Review Tribunal were scrapped and recreated. The Australian Building and Construction Commission was scrapped. Aged care workers are to receive a 15% pay increase. And $5.4 billion will go into early education to make childcare cheaper from the 1st of July. But being in government isn't just all about achieving the things that you said that you would. There's unexpected issues that you do have to deal with. There's inflation issues, there's the cost of living pressures, and these, of course, political problems for the government. There's also energy prices. There's still a lot more to go with many of these issues, especially on climate change policy and economic reform, but I think it's been a year that the Labor government would be quite satisfied with.
Put like that, it's a government of some achievement and major achievement. While we've been critical of it being a cautious government, I think I said this last week, we have to be fair. Anthony Albanese promised a cautious government. On everything but climate change, they've delivered. Now, of course, the sad thing is, and I know a lot of our listeners have already started shouting at the podcast, it's the key one. Nothing else matters if we can't live in the environment. Whether there's plans to fix that that we're not aware of yet, or whether the plans that we have are better than what it looks like they are, we won't know. But that's the one that needs to be the priority. Now, of course, the government needs to balance a lot of interests, things like voters who are skeptical of climate change, union members who work in areas that aren't terribly conducive to environmental reform, members who would rather see the money going to other things. There's been a couple of worrying things over the last week. They announced more money to go into religious schools. I think that's not a great thing at all. I think that no government money should go to any religious organization. And I'm of the belief that really charity is a form of government policy failure. And I'll be fair, noble and worthy organisations such as St Vincent de Paul, the Salvation Army, and the Smith family, who aren't religious, exist and do great work, don't get me wrong. Shouldn't society be in such a state that we don't need them?
Competence and credibility, they're the essential parts of government, and if you lose one of those, you're not going to be in government for too much longer. And it's obvious that that's been the focus of Anthony Albanese's time over the past year. And the Labor government, as you mentioned, David, it has been criticised by some of their supporters for too much focus on just setting up the basics of what government is supposed to do and not enough focus on the things that we'd normally expect to see from a Labor government. Now, I do think that the Labor government has been doing a lot of those things that we'd normally expect to see. It's probably a case of not doing enough of it and not as broadly as it could have been. And a few of our listeners have asked us, well, why is Labor being so risk-averse with implementing some of the bigger picture issues? And I think there's a few reasons for that. Now, first of all, we always arrive at a point today which is based on what's happened in the past. And I get the feeling that the Labor government is still a little bit spooked from their last time in government between 2007 and 2013. They actually had a lot of good ideas that were being developed, and a lot of that came from the 2020 summit that Kevin Rudd set up in 2008. But they were trying to develop too many things at the same time, and Rudd got bogged down in the details of all of those ideas. There was the handling of the global financial crisis as well. There are also all of those issues relating to the mining tax and emissions trading schemes. And because Kevin Rudd didn't have the right sort of factional support behind him, and because he was seen as being very, very difficult to work with, Labor replaced him with Julia Gillard, and that unleashed a whole lot of factional proxy wars that were acted out between 2010 and 2013. And all of this was a disaster for the Labor Party at the time. And I think it helped keep them out of office for almost 9 years. Now, in the same way that the Hawke government in 1983 wanted to avoid the political mistakes of the Whitlam government, which ended 8 years before that in 1975, I think the Albanese government wants to avoid the mistakes made by the Rudd and Gillard governments between 2007 and 2013. Now, I'm not sure if that's an adequate enough explanation for some of this caution, and Albanese might just be a cautious type of politician anyway, but he's definitely not the revolutionary a lot of people might have been expecting him to be.
For the young firebrand coming out of the left, it's been a surprise, I think, for many people. Now, let's ignore for the fact that people mellow as they get older, or at least some do, that the responsibilities of office can slow you down if you're doing the job properly. And the caution may also come from not only Labor's last experience, which had a lot to do with personality. There's a lot of different personalities, or a lot of the more, shall we say, difficult personalities are no longer part of the Labor caucus. A lot of those personalities didn't help good governments and stable government. I think looking at it fairly, they're trying to work in the long term. They've got a lot of damage to repair from the last couple of governments. Not just budgetary damage, and I know that there's a couple of big items that could be easily or seemingly easily removed that would fix things, but I also get the sense we don't have the full details of why these were put in. I'm not ever sure that we will get the full details, but while we're watching our six submarines in 2050 parade up and down Sydney Harbour, of course we won't see them because they'll be underwater. But
well, whatever it is, above water or underwater, will be a sight to behold, David.
It will. But I think too, you know, I don't want to be one of the really loyal party members who are saying, oh, it's long term, we're not there yet, without any thought of looking at why there may be long-term goals here. I think it's fair to say there probably are. I think it's fair to say that looking at the current state of the Liberal Party, Labor can probably expect to retain government, whether in majority or minority, it doesn't matter. There may be a strategic idea of trying to appease at least some of those whose votes they may be reliant on in the next government. But then again, it's easy to look at these things from the outside.
So the government still has a long way to go in many of these areas. And we do have to acknowledge also that building all of these areas up that are in the public interest do take some time. It's a lot easier to cut down and tear these things down, which is pretty much what the Abbott government did when it first got into office back in 2013. But it's a lot more difficult to put those things back once they're gone. And I think the one big thing that we always have to consider is that we had 9 years of incompetent governments during the time of Abbott, Turnbull and Morrison. These were wasted years. They were marred with mismanagement, corruption, ideological warfare, and we're not getting that at the moment. And politics is generally a lot more quiet than it used to be over the past year, and generally this is how the electorate wants it to be. They don't want politics in their face. They don't really think about politics too much or want to have to think about it too much. They just want to know that the government is taking care of things and just doing what we would expect them to do. With all of those coalition governments between 2013 and 2022, there was a drama every single day. There was always some sort of culture war issue or some sort of media stance. It was a politics of conflict. And I think the public eventually got sick and tired of that. So I think that's one massive change over the past year. And sure, the government isn't perfect. It's not impeccable. But we're not seeing as much conflict in politics. And the Conservatives will always try and create friction, even when they're out of office. The latest one is to create an outrage about a drag story time to children at a Melbourne council. So they will keep trying, but I just think that the public has moved on and they appreciate a government that's just getting on with the business of government rather than trying to create fear, division and outrage.
I think that's true. In our somewhat bubble of people interested in politics, there is a lot of impassioned debate. There's disappointment out there, absolutely, and justified disappointment in some cases too, absolutely. There's a little bit of enthusiasm for certain things. There's disagreement on policy, for once. Knowing that, to pick someone at random, Jim Chalmers is doing the job he's being paid for. There's no ulterior motives, and he's not making extremely dodgy deals or paying off vested interests in the budget in not so transparent ways, I think is a revelation to people who had almost forgotten that what that was like. We've got politicians and a cabinet who are generally in the general public and perceptions, everything too, who are generally trusted. And I think that's really important. And I think these things have to be remembered when we're looking at that first year of government, that they were able to change the perception of what a government can and should be with the general public quite quickly. That's not to say that we won't have scandal, that we won't have incompetent ministers, that good ministers will make mistakes when good ministers go bad, for example. That's not to say that there hasn't been disappointing decisions. Various ministers have been pointed out, starting off well and then being disappointing. But I think in general, the government has been travelling fairly well. Is there room for improvement? Sure.
And also, just to go back to that point about comparisons with the Morrison government, and of course, whatever this Labor government does, now it shouldn't just reach the point of saying, oh, well, the Labor government's not doing that much, but it's still better than the Morrison government. Now, I don't think the Morrison government can be used as any sort of yardstick for good government at all. And the Labor government can't just say, well, we're better than the rubbish that preceded us, so that's good enough. Well, that's not good enough. We should always demand more and expect better governance from our governments, whether they are a poor government like the Morrison government was or whether there's a good government in place. They can always improve and become better. But I just think that the Morrison government was demonstrably a bad government and that Scott Morrison was an incompetent prime minister. And I think that the Labor government is streets ahead of any of the performances of the previous coalition governments between 2013 and 2022. Albanese is a far better prime minister. He's probably the best prime minister that we've had since Paul Keating, and if just based on what we're seeing in this first year. And that could all change. And it can change quite dramatically, and it can change quite quickly. Scott Morrison did have two major events that he had to deal with. The bushfires from the 2019 bushfire season, and then the biggest event of all, the pandemic, which commenced in 2020, which we're still feeling the effects of. And Albanese hasn't had these types of events so far. And I think that's a true test of leadership when the going gets really, really tough. And Morrison did fail quite badly in those two big tests that were presented to him. There were other factors involved as well, but that essentially led to his demise as Prime Minister. Anthony Albanese is dealing with some big issues at the moment. Governments always do. And the biggest issue by far is reworking the economy so that it works in the favour of people and not against them. And also trying to undo all of the bad work from the previous coalition governments. And who knows, this might end up being the biggest test that the Labor government will face during its term of office. But you never know what's around the corner. There might be another vicious pandemic out there coming along. But I think you really do find out what a good leader is like when they're facing really tough circumstances.
He hasn't had his test yet. And there's a sense in which, of course, hopefully it won't happen, that he does his X number of years and is able to preside over a country that hasn't had a natural disaster, hasn't had a pandemic, hasn't had a terrorist attack. But it's unlikely that that's the case. I do think even if he fails at it, he won't fail at it in such an egregious and comprehensive manner. as his predecessor. But we won't know till it happens.
And also, I think generally Australia doesn't do that idea of revolutionary change very well. And now it could be argued that the Whitlam government between 1972 and 1975, it wasn't overly revolutionary. It was just bringing up some long-needed changes that should have been introduced after 23 years of Conservative governments and to bring it up to speed with the rest of the world. And some of the changes that the Whitlam government did implement were way ahead of its time. But good government is also about creating stability. And I think that's what the Albanese government has done in its first year. And it has already achieved quite a lot within its first year. And I realise that it's not keeping all of its supporters happy at this stage, but politics is the art of achieving whatever is possible, taking into account the circumstances that do exist at the time, and then sometimes achieving what's impossible. So I think they've definitely done well in this first year. There's definitely a lot more that needs to be achieved, but whether we're comparing their performance to previous recent governments or just in their own right, I think the Labor government is doing quite well.
Yeah, I think I would give them a good, solid, high credit to maybe low distinction at this point. Room for improvement. Again, the environment needs to be looked at as a much higher priority. They've got to stop approving coal mines. And the welfare system has to be fixed in many, many ways. As two things that need to be done as a matter of maybe higher priority. But the stuff they have done has been okay.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through Spotify, YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or you can find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
Housing is becoming more of a focus of attention in federal politics, and at the moment the issue is right across the board. There's the cost of housing, there's the cost of mortgages for people who are paying off a home, there's the price of rent at a time of the tightest rental market in history, there's a lot of people who are homeless and there's not enough social housing at the moment. There's also affordability issues for younger people where most property prices in the cities are out of reach, especially for single people. Now, wherever you look, there are problems. And there have been calls for the federal government to do a lot more than what they're doing at the moment, but there's so many issues to take into account. Now, although there's a Commonwealth State Housing Agreement in place to look at the supply of housing for vulnerable people, responsibility for housing is primarily an issue for the state and territory governments, and this is what's at the heart of the issue. Although most of the governments around Australia are at Labor at the moment, each state and territory government has got its own housing policies. There's different political pressures in each of those states and territories. There's different vested interests. And then when you drill down further, there's local council regulations and requirements as well. But to me, it feels like it's probably time for a national housing summit, because housing problems mean different things to different people. There are many solutions out there, but defining exactly what the problem is in this area is a key issue, because in the past, housing has been at the whim of governments just doing whatever they need to do to get a political advantage out of it, and there needs to be an overarching direction coming in from the federal government.
There's always been a stigma with public housing that there shouldn't be. Shouldn't be a stigma with any form of welfare taken from the government, whether it's old age pension, whether it's a disability pension, whether it's unemployment, whether it's cheaper housing. The system has left people behind, and so the system should be part of the solution of the problem. There is a reluctance to public housing. It's expensive. The NIMBYs hate it. They're not in my backyard crowd. There's classism. There's racism involved. But people living in secure housing surely is much better. I think rental laws need to be looked at. landlords will tell you that they have absolutely no say in this and that all the power goes to renters. Renters will tell you that landlords have all the power and that renters have absolutely no say. There's probably a bit of truth to both, and I think we need to look at fairer ways. I think we've got to remove some of the tax incentive for being able to keep a house empty. But one of the unspoken things is that a fifth of houses in Sydney, and I think the figure is similar in Melbourne, are unoccupied. Some of that is Airbnb and other such organisations. Some of it is people who've gone away for 3 months or something for work or whatever reason. Others, it's just investors have bought a place and rather than have to worry about the upkeep of rent, are just waiting for it to appreciate till they can sell it at a profit. I think we have to look at why are there so many dwellings that are empty and look at getting them filled. That would both bring rents down and go some way at least to alleviating the homeless crisis. And we have to remember too, the biggest demographic in homelessness is women over 55. So I think we've got to look at how do we avoid women over 55 in particular becoming homeless? How do we look after our mentally ill? There's a very high proportion of mentally ill people who just can't keep a household together. We need to start looking at this stuff rather from the eye of the investors, a compassionate eye, and look at how do we sort these problems out.
So I think at the heart of all of this, the essence is that there's not enough houses across Australia, whether they're not being built or they're unoccupied or whatever the case might be, but more houses do need to be built. But the problem is, well, what type of housing? Where is the housing going to be built? How much of it will be built? And most solutions over the years have actually not been solutions at all. The first homeowner grants have mainly pushed property prices up, defeating the purpose of the first homeowner grant in the first place. And most of these policies have been implemented as a grab for votes at election time. And that's what the Howard government housing grants did in the early 2000s. And all they did was make property prices go up in the capital cities. So a lot of these policies and plans have been piecemeal and political quick fixes or outright electoral bribes. And they've tried to address short-term issues. They haven't really provided for any overall vision about what we're trying to achieve with housing policy. And there is that philosophical idea that the solutions are always out there. We just have to find what the problem is in the first place. And I just get the feeling that housing policy is a little bit like this. If we can correctly identify what the problem is, we can then start applying the solutions. And so far, we just haven't been able to do this.
I think there's a bit of a reluctance to find out what the problem is because it's going to hurt someone. The other thing too is that I think the average parliamentarian in federal politics has 14 homes. Now that's an average and lies down lies in statistics, of course.
Well, there was also one National Party MP who owned 50 investment properties.
Yeah. So there are some parliamentarians who own just their own home, others who own one and maybe one other, and then the bigger investors, and that's what drives the average up. But while we have that type of ownership in Parliament, there's not a lot that's going to happen that will be seen to disadvantage owners. And of course, is it fair to knock into people who've worked hard, trademark, saved up trademark?
Mums and dads trademark.
Yeah, mums and dads trademark, the whole thing. It's not a simple solution, but it has to be a better one. I don't think it's right to go around seizing property and nationalizing, but I do think that people can be given the incentive to lower rent, open up houses and properties that perhaps haven't been opened up for whatever reason, to make it a little bit more difficult to make money in the short term. Obviously, one of the things to stop would be negative gearing. But even then, I'm not sure that you should stop it because of the amount of money going in. You don't want to force a crash in the property market as big investors flee for all the reasons you said. A lot of the victims of these types of changes are the people who've got nothing to do with it. People who've just bought a house, they're too much money in debt and then suddenly they can't afford it anymore because the equity in the property has fallen further than perhaps it should have.
And I think all of those issues that you mentioned, it just goes to show how interlinked all of this is. And whatever adjustments are made, this will probably lead to other problems in the housing market and cause unintended consequences. Now, there have been calls, as you mentioned, to end negative gearing benefits for housing or restrict negative gearing to just one investment property. And I think that would be ethically and morally the right thing to do. But that could lead to a housing supply issue, as you mentioned. Changes to capital gains tax, that's what Paul Keating did in 1989, and that caused a rental crisis for close to a year before the Labor government at that time undid those changes. And there's also research that suggests that this current issue in the housing market has been created by lower living density, and that's where people during the pandemic decided that they didn't want to live in shared accommodation with three or four other people and decided to live in homes with less people in them. And that's only a marginal change, but that situation has created a lot of flow-on effects within the housing sector. Now, governments can't really make legislation to enforce that each house has to have a certain amount of people living in them, but they could pass legislation to at least dictate that empty houses should be occupied by at least someone. But I guess this example of living density just goes to show the entire housing sector is very delicately balanced, and there's small movements in one policy area that can cause greater effects elsewhere.
We have to remember too that housing is a right. It's not a privilege. Everybody should have access to a house, whether it's one they've bought themselves, whether it's one that they're renting, whether it's one that is government subsidized or even government given. We shouldn't have homeless people. We shouldn't have people in insufficient accommodation. And if I was in policy, that's where I'd start. How do we fix this? And I know, too, that we'll get the usually from the wealthier end of town, there are homeless people who don't want to live in a house, not as many as you think. We have to look after our most vulnerable. Our least vulnerable can look after themselves, and honestly, that's great. But our least vulnerable, the ones who can't look after themselves, that's the start of any housing policy, I think. How do we fix that first?
Well, just picking up on that point, there just needs to be a drastic rethink about what is the purpose of a home. And the purpose of the home, as you pointed out, is to provide shelter and it's a place to live and enjoy. Maybe over the past 20 years or so, it's moved quite dramatically from a place that you live in to a place that you invest in. And one factor would be to take out the speculation of people purchasing houses just to primarily make money out of it. But then what do we do? Is it just primarily housing corporations that would have build-to-rent properties, which then takes it into the realms of hyper-speculation in the property market? So there's quite a few issues that do need to be looked at here. But the Labor government does have a social housing fund policy in its recent budget, but this has been rejected by the Australian Greens and the Liberal Party. Does the proposal go far enough? Well, probably not. Will it be effective? Well, we don't know because it's not in place yet, but it is something that's on the table and it would be a start. Now, I'm not suggesting that you just dish out any old policy and that will do, but it's not a bad policy. There just isn't enough of it. So I suggest that in this case, get the ball rolling, and a lot of this is a 10 to 20 year plan. It can't be resolved overnight. There's 600,000 social housing homes that are needed right now and possibly close to a million by the year 2040. I'd suggest get this started now and argue for more over the next few months. But I think the more urgent process would be a national housing summit. And I know that you don't want to hit the ground reviewing all the time and just be having endless conferences about this sort of stuff, but there's a lot of solutions out there. There's the tiny house phenomenon. There's the community-based and communal living options. But I think defining what we're trying to resolve has to be the first point. And if there's not enough funding available to achieve what needs to be done right now, at least it sets up a clear direction for what needs to be done in the future. Because at the moment, we just haven't got that on a national level.
We need to remove some of the more prominent voices. The types of housing developers we've seen in Sydney and Melbourne who build units that in Sydney are now falling down and who are doing it for quick profit. We need to get rid of the notion that everybody needs to live on a quarter acre block with a three bedroom house. And these things will take generations to come through. There's a generation of kids now who have basically resign themselves to never actually ever owning a property. Now, in a sense, this isn't such a bad thing. They can invest their savings elsewhere and probably do better. But in another sense, if we're going to have less property ownership, we need better leasing laws and renting laws. 6-month lease isn't enough, unless that's the desire of the renter. Why not have 5-year leases or 10-year leases with maybe slightly less punitive reasons to break if you need to break it for valid reason? There's many valid reasons why you'd break a long lease like that, but there's many valid reasons why you'd stay in the same property for 10 or 12 or more years. There are some landlords who would say, oh, that's just giving more power to the tenant, and they've already got enough power.
Well, I'd say bring it on.
Yeah, I think just having that security that we don't have to think about moving for 10 years, and the landlord doesn't have to worry about an empty and a vacant property when you inevitably kick them out. Rents increased on CPI or by agreement. It's these small steps that work. Again, it's about giving people security, giving people a sense of belonging to a community. This is how communities are built. Of course, developers don't like communities because communities tend not to sell on the property and make the developer more money, etc. But a strong community helps everybody. You get better services, you get more cohesion, you get less social problems. If we fix housing, we fix a lot. And then this leads into the other, or the really the major priority. We can build more dense but ecologically sustainable housing, the small housing movement, for example, slightly denser living. We can fix all that with a little bit of sensible and compassionate thought.
This is the New Politics Podcast, available at Apple and Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, and Amazon Music. And you can support us at Patreon, and also find us at our website, newpolitics.com.au.
There's quite a few other issues going on in federal politics. There were three sets of opinion polls that came out during the week, and they're all showing strong support for both the Prime Minister and for the Labor government. And while there was polling suggesting disappointment with the budget for not doing as much as it could have, the Labor government has increased its support in opinion polls. Now, we do have to remember that opinion polls in politics are always relative to whatever your opponents might be doing, and it's obvious that the Liberal and National parties are having quite a few problems at the moment, but things can change very quickly. The Rudd government was actually in a very similar position a year into its term as well, back in 2008. Its opinion poll numbers were exactly the same as the Albanese government today, 55% to 45% in two-party preferred voting, and at the time, the opposition was in a complete mess under the leadership of Brendan Nelson, and got into an even bigger mess under Malcolm Turnbull when he became the leader of the Liberal Party in 2009. But 18 months later, Rudd was gone as Prime Minister, and the Liberal Party almost won the 2010 federal election under Tony Abbott. So it's good times for the Labor government at the moment, and as we mentioned before, it's probably the best first year of a new government in recent times. But those good times won't last forever.
No, this is where you can burn your political capital on things that your base don't like. If the Tasmanian Liberal Party loses the confidence of the House, and I'll be fair here, I've never quite understood Hare Clark. I've had it explained to me several times, but I've got a mental block.
It's a little bit like cryptocurrency.
Yes, it is a bit like that. But if they do lose the confidence of the House, puts Australia, I think for the second time, 2009, that it's been Labor across the board. The tragedy of the Liberal Party is being writ large, and the difference between 2009 is that there was a way back for the Liberal Party. Unfortunately, that way back was the wrong way back, and it's led us to here. I can't see a way back without massive change. I think that football stadium, which is one of the things that people have rightly criticized the federal government for, I think that football stadium was a mistake for so many reasons when there's so much else that needs to be done. One gets to thinking, how ethical is professional sports management in Australia? That'd be the second state government to be damaged and even brought down by a stadium that was neither needed nor required, first being New South Wales a couple of years back. And not the first anyway, it happens periodically, but this has happened in rather short order. I think it's easy to become cocky too, and I think that's something that all Labor parties have to worry about.
Oh, absolutely. But David, you and I do report on the polls every month, and I think we might have to stop doing this pretty soon because it's pretty much the same story every month, and it's pretty much the same story that it has been over the past year. I could probably even replay the story from a month ago and it'd still be relevant today.
This was absolutely recorded on the date we said it was.
But the upshot is that Labor is doing well. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is doing well. The Liberal and National parties are not doing very well, and the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, is not doing well, then the Labor government is picking up on all of those areas of government as the better manager. The only area that the coalition has got a strong performance in voter perception is in the field of security and defence, and it's only level with the government on national security, and that was traditionally the area that it used to be streets ahead of in voter perception, so it's lost that advantage as well. It's also not perceived to be the better economic manager in these opinion polls, so seems like the public is finally catching up with the reality on that measure. And the media is always quick to look for signs that the honeymoon is over for a new government, and all of this is a media cliche anyway, but the continuing high polls for the Labor government are a sign that the electorate is getting used to this form of government. They like what they're doing, and they look at the other side and they can't see the merits of the opposition. And essentially, the opposition doesn't have that much to offer at this point of time. And maybe at this stage of the political cycle, they don't have to offer very much to the electorate. But you'd think at least they could put in some effort and try a little bit harder. Here's the Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor, at the National Press Club this week.
I'd like to ask you about something you said in your address when you said inflation is coming from Canberra now, not the Kremlin. Mm. But around the time that the coalition government you were a part of handed down its last budget, former Prime Minister Scott Morrison blamed inflation on factors outside of the government's control, such as Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So I'd like to ask you, what's changed between then and now? Why was inflation something that was outside of the coalition's control, but is now, as you say, able to be controlled by Labor, especially given the war in Ukraine is still going?
Well, the key to answering that question is that we're not in government, Labor is now. So it's within their control and it's not within ours. But I've laid out what I think is an agenda that will address it, that's our strong focus.
Responses like that are totally ridiculous, and the media doesn't point it out. And here's another one from Senator Jane Hume.
I think it was Winston Churchill that said, taxing your way out of a budget crisis is like lifting yourself up by the handle, lifting yourself, standing in a bucket with the handle. Something as articulate as that, I'm sure Winston Churchill said.
That response was actually called out by the media, but if you are going to quote Winston Churchill, at least get your quotes right. Otherwise, you look like a complete fool.
As Arthur Conan Doyle said, don't believe everything you read on the internet. They've got research people. Maybe it's a veiled attack on the Albanese government cutting the number of staffers. And yes, I'll be fair too, in the heat of the moment, and it happens to me all the time, you accidentally misattribute to the wrong person, or you get the quote slightly wrong while you're on your feet talking. But it was clearly prepared. She'd been waiting to use that, or she was ready to use it and got it wrong. It doesn't take much to double check that that's what's happening, you know. And I'm rather forgiving of even bad politicians genuinely misspeaking. But in this case, it seems that she was just lazy. So it doesn't help when you're trying to build. I really think that the purge has to happen and most of the current Liberal Party has to go. They just have to be sent off to other parts of society. Some, of course, to court or to trial to see if they're as guilty as it seems. others were just useless and should be just retired to pasture and given a soft job somewhere out of government.
Now, there's always going to be something that causes problems for the government, and it's usually when it's least expected. And we discussed this earlier before about what's going on in Tasmania, but there was a very good example of unexpected things coming up. And the last Liberal government in Australia has lost its majority and is now governing in minority. And all of this relates to that AFL stadium deal that you mentioned before, David. That's in Hobart, and this was announced a few weeks ago. And there is a stadium that is due to be built in time for the new AFL team in Tasmania in 2028, and the stadium is due to cost $715 million. And two Liberal MPs have resigned in protest at this deal, and that's at a time when Tasmania is facing extreme housing shortages and homelessness. The federal government, as you mentioned, did pledge $240 million towards this project, but as we predicted several weeks ago, any blowback for this would come to the Premier, Jeremy Rockcliffe, and not to Anthony Albanese, and that's exactly what has happened in this case. Now, the interesting issue about this is that the Tasmania Liberal Party seemed to be in a relatively secure place. In the 2021 Tasmania election, and that's the only election that the Liberal Party has won anywhere since 2019, they received 49% of the vote to 28% for the Labor Party and 28% to the Tasmania Greens. But because of that unexplainable Hare-Clark system, they only had a bare majority of one seat. So they held 13 of the 25 seats. And with the loss of those two Liberal MPs, they're in minority now. So at this stage, they're only one or two bad decisions away from total oblivion. They're not due for an election until 2025, but their system will increase the amount of seats from 25 to 35 at the next election, whenever that's held. So it's not looking very good for the last Liberal government in Australia. But I think the other big lesson for the federal government and for Anthony Albanese is that a secure-looking government can become very, very insecure very, very quickly and is always just one or two bad decisions from a self-made disaster.
A week is a long time in politics. It should be engraved in the wall of every prime minister, and cock of the walk one day, feather duster the next is the other one. I mentioned it earlier that complacency is going to be the big enemy. When you don't have an effective opposition, when you don't have someone who is able to hold you to proper account, not just yell insults and irrelevancies and suck up the airtime and not do much else, you can't afford to be complacent. When you don't have someone like that, it's very easy to become very complacent. And even when you do have an effective opposition, you can be complacent. The end of the Howard years was a very complacent government, even though there was the very good opposition of Kevin Rudd and the shadow government there. It's very easy too, as we're watching the historic collapse of the Liberal Party, to not worry about what's happening because you're going to win the poll anyway. And of course, as we continually hear around election time, there's only one poll that matters. And that's absolutely true. And Australians, I think, have suggested that they don't mind minority government. If you have a good government, Western Australia, Mark McGowan, Dan Andrews in Victoria, and a Palaszczuk in Queensland, you'll get re-elected. And then your polling figures don't matter between those. And that was true of John Howard too. He had very low approval ratings in the middle of terms, and he was able to manage them so they went back up at the time where it counted. When you're on high approval ratings, it's really just a matter of more people to disappoint. And I think that's something you've got to remember. Kevin Rudd was still insanely popular when they dumped him from office. And one of the factors given was, the drop in polls. He went from an unsustainable 72% to a fairly unsustainable 63%, and that's when they dumped him. And I remember John Howard saying, I had much lower figures than that. Of course, there were other reasons why they wanted to get rid of Kevin Rudd, if the memoirs and interviews, etc., are to be believed. And that was just one excuse rather than a reason. But nonetheless, complacency is where it might be the built-in self-destruct button, this government.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. And if you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.